Wow, wonderful passage with lots of very strange things in it. But let's look at it together, shall we? We live in a world that is and abides by justification by works. The religions of the world tell us to do things. Everyone says this is what you should do or not do. And everyone is looked upon by what works they do. People try to get around that by, on social media, telling us that they're great and showing those snippets of their lives which show them in a good light. If you work in professions, the professional standards are there and they tell you how to behave and what to do. I have as yet seen anyone that can hold up to those professional standards. We in our lives know that we are people that are flawed. We know that we are people that do wrong, that we sin. And we come to a God and we ask of him, why does he take any interest in us? We know our flaws and our failures. We know our sinfulness. Why would he be interested in me? How could he use someone like me in the world today? How can I follow him? Well, here today we're going to see more of the character of God. And we're going to see the person that we worship. We're also going to see a man, Moses, who in the scriptures say that he is a man that did things by faith. If you look at Hebrews 11, it says, by faith Moses, by faith Moses, by faith Moses. Yet in here we see a man who is flawed, who's an ordinary man, just like the rest of us. We see a man that God's going to use. You see a man that God is going to use to rescue his people, Israel. And as we go through this passage, we're going to see Moses, who actually wrote this book, we're going to see him, warts and all. And we'll also see the God that saves, the merciful God, and how he deals with us. So we've got three things that we'll try and look at this passage under. Moses, the flawed prophet and Israelite. The second, the gracious saving God. And third, who the true Moses actually is. So let's just, if you weren't here last week or the weeks previous, get you a background to this section. Moses is 80 years old. He has spent 40 years in the wilderness. He has come across a burning bush. He's come to Mount Horeb. And he has met God. He's met the second person of the Trinity. God has told him that he knows the suffering of the Israelite people. And that Moses is going to be the person who's going to deliver him. You can see that in 3 verses 8 and 7, 7 and 8. And God will send Moses to Pharaoh to tell him to let them go. Moses starts off by asking a few questions. He's unsure of this. And the first objection he gives is, who am I to do this? God gives him a promise and says, I will be with you, and a sign I will give you. You will come back to this place and you will serve me on this mountain. He then asks another question. Who shall I say sent me? And God says, I am. And tells him exactly who he is. And he tells him exactly how this is actually going to come out and pan out. The whole story is put in front of him. And he says in verse 18 of the previous chapter, he says, and they will listen to your voice, talking about and you and the elders will go to Pharaoh. So he's given them a promise. And then we turn to this first question of the next chapter. It seems reasonable at first. But behold, they will not believe me or listen to my voice, for they will say, Yahweh did not appear to you. Why would he say this? Is it because in the past he has spoken to them, as he did in chapter 2, and they said, who are you that make you rule and judge of us? Maybe he's thinking about that. Maybe things have happened in his 40 years in the wilderness that means that he lacks any belief that he would be that person. But it does, in reality, show that he lacks belief in God's promise of verse 18, that they would listen to his voice and they would go to Pharaoh and speak to him. This lack of faith is shown, but God responds. He gives him three signs. And he says, these are the signs you'll show the elders, that Moses, you are my prophet. They will listen to your voice, and these are the signs you will do. He gives them the signs of the staff, a sign of the leprous hand, and the sign of the blood of the Nile. We will look at that a little bit later. But I want us to move on to the next objection. We're starting to see what Moses is really about here for these questions. He says, but I'm not eloquent of speech. Acts 7:22 tells us when Stephen speaks about Moses that he was instructed in all the wisdom of the Egyptians and he was mighty in his words and deeds. We don't know what's happened to him. Is he shy? Does he stumble over his words now? Is his Egyptian quite rusty and he's unable to speak like he used to? Whatever it is, he has this objection. He even blames God for this speech issue that he has. If you look there, he says that, I am not eloquent either in the past or since you have spoken to your servant, but I am slow of speech and of tongue. He blames God and he says, I can't do this. God then tells him, well, here is what I'll give you. Number one, I have made your mouth. I have made everything. It is my mouth. I will be with your mouth. I will teach you what you shall speak. And he's commanded to go. We're now at a place where Moses can't really find any other objections. We have Moses who's basically saying, well, I haven't got anything else to do. So he says, oh my Lord, please send me. No, he doesn't say that, does he? He says, oh my Lord, please send someone else. Notice when I was reading, I said Yahweh for most of it. But there were two instances where he says, my Lord. And this is one of them. It sounds respectful enough, but rarely he's not using God's revealed name. He isn't using the name God gave him to use, Yahweh. He is not acknowledging God's sovereignty. He's not acknowledging God's majesty. He's basically saying, I don't want to obey you. At this point, we have God who is burning with anger. It literally means the nose of the Lord heated up. He snorted. He is really angry here. But if we remember Habakkuk 3 verse 2, it says, in wrath, remember mercy. And God does. He gives him another graceful response. He gives him Aaron. He says, your brother, he's going to come and meet you. He will be your mouthpiece. He will support you. And that is one positive thing and also a negative thing. This support for Moses will be like Pharaoh has support. The Pharaohs used to have the mouth of the king, a person, an Egyptian official that would speak on their behalf. Maybe this is where Aaron is going to be, the one speaking on the behalf of Moses. It also will show us the relationship God has with his prophets. In the picture of Moses with Aaron, God is going to speak to Moses and then Aaron is going to speak what Moses says to him. And that's what prophets do. They speak the words of God and they do the signs that may accompany those to show that they are God's prophets. But there are consequences for this unbelief. There's a bit of discipline here. He's going to lose that prestige that he would have had. We don't know what blessings would have come from him just being the sole speaker and being the prophet rather than Aaron. Not only that, it's going to bring Aaron into a place where he's going to have some standing amongst the people. When Moses is away on that mountain later on, they're going to turn to Aaron and they're going to ask him to make that calf and worship God through that and bring them into great sin. So we have here Moses, an ordinary man. He lacks faith in God and his promises. He's like the Israelites. We've seen throughout the whole picture so far that he's had his own little exodus. He was cast in the waters of the Nile in the little ark. He then went in and fled into the wilderness for 40 years. He had little faith. He was unwilling to obey. He was unwilling to do what God commands. And Moses is going to feel what God feels when it comes to the true exodus, when they actually go out into the wilderness themselves as the Israelites. But Moses, even though he's like that, he will be used as an instrument in saving the unbelieving and the unfaithful Israelites. It's God who will do this work. And how God responded to those objections of Moses is something that we can get encouragement from, and how he responds to us as well. We're going to see how he deals with Pharaoh, and we're going to see how he deals with Moses in the end as well. So let's look at the second thing, the gracious saving God that we have. We go back to the objections and how God responded in more detail. That might help us see what this wonderful, gracious God we have who would use this flawed man, Moses. First of all, he gives him signs. He doesn't give him just two witnesses. He gives him three. That's gracious. You only need to have two witnesses, but he gives him three. Those signs are going to be those visible manifestations of the divine power. They will validate Moses as God's prophet. They will show the elders and the Israelites and eventually the Pharaoh and Egyptians that this is the God who will save, not a mere man. So we turn to this ordinary staff, the staff that God uses, Moses' shepherd's staff. It's just an ordinary staff. He's told to place it and throw it on the ground. He does so. It turns into a serpent. What's this trying to show? It's showing that this serpent is a picture of the power that the Egyptian pharaoh has. On their scepter they would have a cobra or a serpent of some kind, and they'd also have it on their hat. When both kingdoms have come together. So it's a claim of divine royalty, of sovereignty, of power, the serpent, and it's the power of the gods. What is Moses told to do? He's told to pick up this staff, which is now a serpent, by the tail. He's not told to just pick it up. He's told to grip it firmly. That's what the words mean. He sort of snatches at it, meekly. Okay? He grabs cautiously the tail, because of course that tail is not the right end that can actually do the harm, isn't it? It is the other end, and he knows that it could actually hit, attack him. So he grabs it by the tail, and it becomes a staff again. This is telling us that God has power over the Egyptians, over their king, over the gods of the Egyptians. God is saying, obey me, for my enemies will be made powerless by my hand. And this ordinary staff is going to become the staff of God. If you read later on, it says the staff of God. Take the staff of God, and he took the staff of God in his hand in verse 20. This is a really important thing to remember, this staff. It's an ordinary staff, yet it's going to become extraordinary in the hands of God. It's going to bring about the plagues on Egypt. It's going to be used to part the Red Sea. It's going to be used to bring destruction on the Egyptians when the sea crashes down upon them. It's going to be used to bring the water out of the rock as he strikes it and bringing water to the people that need it. It's going to be used to be uplifted as they conquer the Amalekites. It is a powerful staff, but only an ordinary staff, just like we are, ordinary people. Francis Schaeffer said something about this section, and he said the following, if I can find it. Consider the mighty ways in which God used a dead stick of wood. God so used a stick of wood can be a banner cry for each of us. Though we are limited and weak in talent, physical energy and psychological strength, we are not less than a stick of wood. But as the rod of Moses had to become the rod of God, so that which is me must become the me of God. That's a wonderful, comforting thing. He can use us, just like he used that staff, to do mighty things. Let's look at the next thing. The leprous hand. Highly infectious, incurable, caused seclusion from others, from society. A depiction of sinfulness. And what God can do to that. He puts it in, it comes out leprous, showing the pollution he has of his hand. He puts it back into his cloak and it brings it out and it's restored. It's made whole. God says, obey me, for the pollution that you have in you can be made clean. Both of these things happened in his eyes. But the next one doesn't happen in his eyes. He's given it as a promise of what will happen. God's power over the Nile is shown. The source of life to the Egyptians. God's judgment is shown here. It's transforming transforming power. God is saying, I'm sacred, I'm powerful. The Nile doesn't give life, I give life. And here we have God dealing directly with those fears that Moses had. Will they listen to me? Well, it will confirm God's word. It won't be like the Egyptian wise men who will cast spells. This will be a sign. It will be God working. And it will show God's people that Moses is speaking the truth from God. But not only that, this will be a sign of judgment to the Pharaoh and the Egyptians, as we see in verse 21, where he says, he will go and you will do all these miracles I have put in your power, but I'll harden his heart. Next, grace is given in Moses' words. God graciously, patiently promises emphatically to Moses to be his mouthpiece, to be his teacher, to be his supplier of words. That is the next thing that happens to those objections. Moses is given the signs, he's commanded to go, and he's given promises. We're given promises, aren't we? We're given promises that he will never leave us or forsake us. He's told us he will bring us through to the end. We have got many promises, and we should take those on board and hold on to the promises God gives us. He then gives him, for the next objection, support and encouragement. He says, well, Aaron will do that support, but I'll also encourage you by this. I will be with your mouth. I'll be with Aaron's mouth. I will teach both of you what to do. I will, yes, he will be your spokesman, but he will tell only the words that you tell him from me. So God's using this not perfect man, but a sinful man to actually do that. A man who lacks belief, just like us. And he gives grace. Now, that's not where it ends. We've got the rest of the story. We have Moses, who at this point is going to go back. He has now got enough faith, I suppose you could say, to actually start going back. He goes back. He's going to do that. But the narrative has two people, three people that are going to be groups that are going to be involved. We've got Moses, we've got Pharaoh, and we've also got the people of Israel. As he returns to Egypt, first of all goes to Jethro, his father-in-law, asks if he can go back, and then he goes back on a donkey to the land of Egypt, and he says to Moses, God says to Moses, what will happen? Some more detail. He's going to tell him that Pharaoh's heart is going to be hardened. He's going to tell him that he's going to do the miracles in front of them, and he's not going to understand. He's going to harden his heart. He says that God will harden his heart. This is a difficult thing to hear, isn't it? How can God harden his heart? Isn't that unfair, people often say? But this hardening is twofold. Moses talks about it later on. He talks about Pharaoh hardening his own heart, and he talks about God hardening Pharaoh's heart. There seems to be a paradox of divine sovereignty and human responsibility here. If you were here when we were reading through Romans, you would have come across in Romans 1:24, it said that God gave them up in the lusts of their hearts, those that would do wrong. Pharaoh's heart hardening was following his own desires. God took away his restraining of his desire. Tim Keller says about this when he talks about hardening of hearts. He says, when God hardens someone, he doesn't create the hardness. He simply allows the person to go his or her own way. God hardens those he wants to harden, and all those whom he hardens want to be hardened. So he's going to harden Pharaoh's heart. That's one person he's going to deal with. But why does God, this gracious God, care so much for the Israelites? They're an insignificant, small group with no strength. Why go to so much trouble to free these people from slavery? Well, we see that in verse 22. Israel is my firstborn son. It is the son of God's choice. He chose them. This isn't about emancipating slaves. This is about bringing a son and freeing him and repatriating him with the son, with his father. It is not a master-slave relationship, which it is at the moment. It's going to be a father-son relationship that he's going to have. And why is he going to do this? He's going to do it because he wants them to be free to serve and worship him. The Egyptians are going to refuse to listen. They're going to find that will be the expense of their firstborn sons. And firstborn sons were very important to the Egyptians. They're going to find them dead. This is an exodus is about the love of a father for his son. This is why God's judgment on the Egyptians is going to be so strong. And that's how Israel is going to be seen by God. He's going to free them. He's going to free them from this slavery so they'll be free to go into the world and worship him. And isn't that like us with Satan? We and the law, we are in under our sin and we feel it, and yet God frees us from that when we are saved into Christ. And this is a picture of that. Then we have the next thing. We have how God deals with Moses. So Moses is going along towards Egypt, and what does Yahweh do? At a lodging place on the way, Yahweh met him and sought to put him to death. God seeks to slay him. The language in this area is going to be pretty vague. But most of the translate that this is Moses that he's seeking, and this is what is going to happen. He's seeking his life to put him to death. Why would God do this? What about Moses? Isn't he meant to be the one that is going to be the intended instrument for Israel's salvation? Isn't he the one that's meant to lead the people out of Egypt? Is he one, the one that's meant to meet the elders? Isn't he the one that's going to be the prophet, perform the miracles, demand the release of Israel, God's firstborn? Surely this will jeopardize the whole Exodus. He's under God's wrath. And how is it dealt with? How does he save God? How does God save Moses? Well, it's by Zipporah circumcising his son. This is why he's under wrath. It's because he hasn't been obedient to God in circumcising his son. Why is that more important than all these objections to God that we've just had? You know, even, I don't want to go. Why is this so much more awful that God once seeks him to put him to death? Well, it's a sign of the membership of him and his family of the covenantal community of Israel. He hasn't done the duty as an Israelite man. He hasn't set an example. How will he be able to bring God's covenantal people out when he can't keep the covenant himself? He's denying the gospel because this covenantal promise that comes through circumcision is only done through circumcision, and he denies the gospel. It's a picture of what it, turning God's wrath away. And this is what this circumcision does. There we have it. The foreskin touches Moses' feet and God's wrath is turned away. He could have died many times, but his wrath has been turned away. God's wrath has been turned away. The blood was shed. The son's blood was shed in this case. Did that actually save him from the wrath of God? Hebrews 10 tells us it was impossible for the blood of bulls and goats to take away the sins of the people. But it was a sign of the true sacrifice when God saw that shed foreskin on his feet. It turned God's wrath away because it was a symbol of Christ's single sacrifice that he would save his people from their sins. And only Christ's sacrifice can do that. So we've come to this place where Moses is going to go, he's going to do these signs, and the people are going to bow and worship God. But all this picture shows us a man who's flawed, and then God graciously uses. And he's pointing every time to the true Moses. The Moses that we are looking forward to. Moses is and does look like a redeemer of Israel, but he's a breaker of God's law. He lacks faith. He's a flawed prophet. He hasn't been a good Israelite. He hasn't circumcised his children. He has had to be saved from the wrath of God by the shedding of blood. Pictures here have been shown to us that will come across again in Matthew and in his gospel. We have Moses taking his wife and sons and going on a donkey and journeying to Egypt in this case, but we know that happens to Jesus when he flees from Herod and he goes to Egypt. Stephen talks about this as well. He talks about Moses being the type of Christ and uses words that Moses uses when he talks about the greater Moses coming, who God said this, I'll raise up for them a prophet like you from among their brothers. And Matthew and Stephen point to Christ being the true Moses. Where Moses failed, Christ doesn't. Christ is perfect. He's the great prophet. He is the only true Israelite. He's the one that kept God's law perfectly. He was the only one that was faithful. He's the only one that took the wrath of God for others by the shedding of his blood. Both fled a ruler that was out to kill them. Both went back to where God commanded them to go. Both were in somewhere for 40 periods of time, one 40 years and one for 40 days, being tempted. Yet Moses didn't want to obey. Christ did, even to the death on the cross. Moses was given miracles to authenticate who he was. Christ did miracles and authenticated his teaching to prove he was the Messiah. He was given signs, but Christ gave the sign of the empty cross, the sign of his wounds in him, the sign of an empty tomb, and his ascension. Christ is given to us as a sign, and we are commanded to obey. Not only that, Christ is the true Israel. Israel's unfaithful, unbelieving, goes into a wilderness through a Red Sea for 40 years, and then goes into a promised land. Christ goes through the waters of baptism, goes into temptation for 40 days, goes and dies for us, and goes into the promised land ahead of us. Moses never went into that promised land, did he? But Christ has gone before. So Jesus is that true Israelite, that true Israel. He is the true Moses. And we can be part of that true Israel. If you're one of Christ, you are united to him. You inherit the promises. You are sons, daughters, heirs with Christ. But if you're not one of those people, you will not have that. You will have the judgment that Pharaoh would have. Your heart will be hardened because you want it hardened, and God will allow it. He calls you every single time you hear the gospel to come to him and to believe. Will you believe? Will you come to him? Will you believe in the Lord Jesus Christ to be saved from your sins? Or will you be like Pharaoh, who will have his heart hardened and one day no more could actually turn to Christ? Or will you be like those that have been saved? Will you look towards Jesus' life, death and resurrection? It clothes us. We are right in front of God. He then sees us by faith, Moses, by faith, Moses. He says that to us as well, because we are Christ's. We can then hold on to God's promises. We are flawed, we lack faith, we sin, but he looks on Christ and turns his wrath away from us. That is a wonderful thing. We have the signs of an empty cross. We have the signs of an empty tomb. We have the signs of baptism. We have the signs of the Lord's Supper that tell us that we're united to Christ and that we will be with him forever. This is true for us. And from that, we can then go out and obey just like Moses did. We might lack faith, but he says, I will be with you. And please remember the promises he gives you, the signs he gives you, and don't fear. In those times when you have to stand up for the truth, in those times when you do not know what to say and someone comes upon your way that needs the gospel, and in every ordinary part of your life, remember that you are Christ's and you have those wonderful promises he gave Moses, you have been given through Christ.